From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from Macon, Georgia, and we're in the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting and very grateful to be here. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
We've developed a very precise, very effective weapon that can take out terrorists.
68-year-old woman, mom and a baby, was killed in a drone strike.
After examining 9 out of 45 recent strikes by U.S. drones, Amnesty maintain that a number of the victims that died were unarmed.
You may have seen the headlines this week about 2 explosive new reports just out from Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch about the toll on civilian lives being taken by the U.S. strategy of using military drones in Pakistan and Yemen, as well as elsewhere in the Middle East. The fact is, there are significant problems, both moral and strategic problems, with deploying mechanized killing machines half a world away. And on this week's show, I'll be talking to a leading peace ethicist and theologian, as well as activist, Dr. Glenn Stassen.
I wanted my children to be global citizens and to be literate in both of their ancestral religions.
In our increasingly diverse society, it's less and less unusual for individuals from different faith backgrounds to come into regular contact with each other. And it's more and more common for them to marry and raise children. But will those kids grow up with one faith, or no faith, or maybe with both? That's the possibility that's explored in a brand new book titled Being Both, Embracing 2 Religions in 1 Interfaith Family. And on this week's show, I'll be talking with the author, Susan Katz Miller. But first,
let's repeal this failure.
Political interference a month out hid the problem and buried the information they didn't want seen.
Before it literally kills women.
I would argue that the problems go much further than that.
Kills children.
People who are losing their jobs, who are losing their health care.
Kills senior citizens.
You know, it's been a messy, messy few weeks since the official launch of the Affordable Care Act. I think it's not inaccurate to say that the Obama administration and the Department of Health and Human Services have made it about as easy as possible for opponents of the law to find fault with, poke fun at, and otherwise politicize an initiative that underneath all the rhetoric advances a proposition that few Americans could honestly disagree with. In the richest country in the world, individuals and families should not be deprived access to health care. Or, put it another way, we do not believe that if you're poor, you deserve to have a shorter, sicker life. Somehow managing to rise above what at times must seem like an endless losing battle are faith-inspired leaders like our first guest on this week's show, the Reverend Jennifer Butler. As the founding CEO of the influential nonprofit Faith in Public Life, Jen has worked closely with Sister Simone Campbell, whom all of you know, and others as well, on the contemporary issues that are too often portrayed as political when, in fact, they define who we are morally and spiritually. Reverend Butler, welcome to State of Belief Radio again.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you would, I'd like you to start by talking about the status of the Affordable Care Act. We've seen a troubled launch of the most visible part, the website, and a judge has agreed to rule on a state-level challenge come February. Opponents continue to hatch new obstacles. Jen, how would you grade where things stand as of this moment?
Well, already 100 million Americans have benefited from the Affordable Care Act. You know, I tell you, nothing can quench my enthusiasm for this law, because we know that this law fixes what was a morally bankrupt healthcare system in this country that did not protect the vulnerable in our society. And right now, faith leaders across the country are working to enroll communities and are really helping to implement this law. And we're very excited about this historic moment.
I was struck by the informal way in which the president spoke in the Rose Garden this past week. His emphasis on the available savings to individuals and families makes some political sense, but I wanted him to do as he's done before and talk about this call for moral engagement. Why do you think we didn't hear there the language of the common good?
Well, the president should be strong on that, and he certainly was when he was working to pass the bill. In fact, faith leaders from across a diverse range of communities, from evangelical to Catholic to Jewish to Muslim to Protestant, all worked to get the president onto a national call-in that had 150,000 participants. And the president really got on the bully pulpit and spoke about the morality of health care reform. I know this president really believes that this is a moral issue for America. And we had a system that prevented people who had pre-existing health conditions from actually having health care coverage. Half of all Americans have pre-existing conditions. It was egregious. So you're right. It is a moral issue, and the president can certainly speak eloquently to that.
Can you point out who in the religious community is so opposed to this legislation?
Well, here's one of the great ironies and hypocrisies, right? The Christian right groups who call themselves pro-family and pro-life and Christian are the very groups that oppose this legislation and oppose now the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. And that's just plain hypocritical. This law will save lives. And if you are pro-life and you want to protect families and protect unborn children and protect children, then you should be for this law. But I should say that many, many evangelicals and many pro-life Catholics supported this legislation and support now the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and are working very hard to make that happen.
The only way that makes sense is to say that the opponents are not treating it as a moral issue so much as a partisan political issue. Is that right?
I would say that they've politicized the issue. I mean, there is nothing pro-life or Christian about taking health care away from families that need it. It's shameful. And I do think that they've gotten sucked into a political agenda, and a lot of the faith community's work has been about dispelling some of the misinformation that they have put out there about this important historic piece of legislation.
Mm-hmm. Whenever there's talk of employers dropping workers to save a few bucks, I can't help but think how unpatriotic as well as immoral that is, and the same goes for so much of the rest of the self-centered language among opponents of this act. There are a lot of people in this country that need to know how to talk about this in defending it. How should they talk about it?
I think it is so important to come out and tell our personal stories. I was talking to my father, and he did not realize at the time that one of his children did not have health care coverage, and they were about to have a child. And I asked him, how much do you think it costs today for a couple to have a baby? He said, well, back in my day, it was a couple $100s. I was like, Dad, it is now $10,000 or more to have a child in a hospital. Often we're embarrassed to talk about people we've known or even incidences that we've had of not having health care coverage and how vulnerable we felt, or examinations or tests that we should have gotten that we passed up because we were afraid we couldn't afford them. Mm-hmm. I think we all need to tell our stories because people then, I think, can really resonate and have empathy for one another.
Jen, I know that Faith in Public Life has done an awful lot of work around this issue, and you have developed partnerships with other faith-based organizations. I'd like for our listeners to know some of the specifics of the kind of work you've done on the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, it was a very exciting time because there were so many different sectors of the faith community uniting around this legislation because it was such a moral issue. And so one of the things we did during 2009 when the Tea Party started to have town halls around the country, and they were eroding support for healthcare and spreading misinformation, we worked with the faith community to host a call-in with President Obama that drew 300,000 listeners and really shifted the momentum going into that fall. And then we worked with members of the faith community in six key states on the bill to make sure that those members of Congress voted for this bill. And there was a very exciting moment where Senator Nelson was on the fence about the bill, and we had organized through Interfaith Worker Justice and PICO National Network in that state to get religious leaders to come out in support of the bill. Faith and Public Life worked with them to get media coverage of their position. And we had actually pro-life and pro-choice religious leaders on the bill, and they spoke out very strongly saying, this is a pro-life bill, this is going to save lives. And that was instrumental in getting Senator Ben Nelson's vote. We know this because he turned around and featured the faith leaders that were on that letter in an ad interpreting his vote to his constituents. So I was very proud at that moment of the faith community and what we had done. In fact, I would say that this legislation probably would not have passed without the support and the hard work of the faith community.
Yeah. I think it's safe to say, because I know the work you've been doing, that you've done a masterful job in bringing together both the political activism that's needed, but also the aspect of spirituality and spiritual concern that are a part of the interfaith work that's done, and you've done both of those.
Yeah, and that's been really important to us. I mean, so often we can get in the weeds of talking about, you know, the business aspect of a particular bill or some of the pragmatic aspects, but this is about who we are as a country, and it's interfaith leaders that can really raise up that aspect of the many issues that we're debating today, whether that's the government shutdown or the budget plan. The budget is a moral document, and we need to be helping Americans understand that everything we do as a country needs to be viewed through a moral lens, especially if we're to preserve the kind of democracy that we want to have here in America.
A lot of people say to me, and I'm sure to you, your institutions, your agencies can have an important influence here. But back where we live, we're not sure what we ought to be doing. What should people who support this act be doing in relation not just to convincing their neighbors about it, but in speaking to political leaders about it?
Well, it's very important right now to make sure that the aspect of the American Care Act that is Medicaid expansion goes through. Medicaid expansion is a piece of the legislation that calls for the expansion of Medicaid to not just cover the very poor, but to cover the working poor, people who work for a living but still can't afford what health care will cost. And so far, 25 states have accepted that program and are receiving federal dollars to get that program going, but 25 states are actually still opposing or debating this, which means that a good segment of the population would go uncovered, and it would make it much, much harder to implement this very important piece of legislation. And so right now, for example, in Ohio, faith leaders there spoke very strongly to the moral aspect of implementing Medicaid expansion. And Governor Kasich actually spoke, and he's a Republican governor, he spoke on moral terms about this. He actually stood in opposition to many in his party, accepted Medicaid expansion, has fought for it. They recently scored a big victory in that state, and he has spoken about it in Christian terms, saying, this is the moral thing to do. I'm called to be my brother and my sister's keeper. And so the faith community has stood in support of him and really encouraged him as he's taken this very courageous stand against members of his own party. But there are other states where we need to work hard to protect Medicaid expansion and to make that happen. And those are states like Texas and Georgia and Alabama and Idaho and Utah. And so if you're in one of those states, and you can just Google that, you should give us a call at Faith and Public Life. We'd be happy to help you write opinion pieces, to help do press conferences with religious leaders, because what it comes down to is this is a moral issue. We are called as people of faith to protect the most vulnerable of society, and if we're not doing that, we're not following our faith traditions.
The Reverend Jennifer Butler is the founding CEO of Faith in Public Life, a strategy center for the faith community, advancing faith in the public square as a powerful force for justice, compassion, and the common good. And, Jen, you have given us absolutely superb information and good guidance for people wanting to be more active in this. It's what Faith in Public Life does so well, and I thank you for taking time to be with us today talking about this issue here on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you.
Later in the show, Susan Katz-Miller, who's just published a book about raising multi-faith kids in an interfaith family. The U.S. military and the Obama administration have worked hard to minimize public awareness of the controversial drone program. But this past week, two leading human rights organizations published reports that raise some very serious concerns. Reading the work of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch investigators is less of a revelation. Absolute accuracy in remotely guided drone attacks has never been a credible claim, no matter how often it's been repeated, and actually it's been more of a direct challenge to our collective conscience as a nation. So how do we justify the loss of innocent lives when we are so insulated from being splashed with the blood of the victims? What mandate do people of faith have to act in the face of these revelations? And how counterproductive are these actions when the stated goal is to combat terrorism? Joining me right now, though, is Dr. Glenn Stassen, a highly respected ethicist and theologian and activist, a professor at Fuller Theological Seminary in California. And I'm grateful to be able to say that he's a dear friend who knows answers to these questions, and he's willing to share them. Glenn, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks so much, Wilson, for getting me on.
Looking at both of these reports, the authors admit the difficulty of gathering accurate statistics. What's undeniable, however, is that the drone attacks are happening and our government is evading accountability to its citizens for deaths being perpetrated in our name. So would you start by talking about that disconnect?
Yeah, see, the problem is that since we never get reports on what attacks happened, who was attacked, who was killed, we can't do the role of the conscience of the nation saying, is this right or is this wrong? It's going on in a vacuum without our knowing, so it doesn't have the checks and balances that are built into our constitutional system.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, the government has never published what are their policies. You know, what are the limits? Whom do they attack? Whom do they not? There is a policy there, we're told, but the people don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, there's this vacuum, this lack of checks and balances, which is essential to our democratic system.
What about the inherent disconnect of remote control killing machines deployed over a faraway land?
Yeah, they can't really see for sure whom they're killing. So what these two new reports are pointing out is, I mean, for example, in one case, they targeted a grandmother who was out gathering some vegetables surrounded by her little grandchildren. You know, obviously that's not a terrorist target, and they can't be sure whom they're hitting looking from thousands and thousands of miles through these drones.
You have done so much work on not only peacemaking in general, but on the just war theory and related ethical issues. I'd be very interested to hear the questions that you find yourself asking about this whole drone strategy.
Well, you see, my specialty, Welton, actually is I've led the scholars who've developed a new paradigm called just peacemaking.
Right.
I think it's actually much more useful for this case and many others than just war, because just war theory says it's appropriate to attack a military target that's attacking you, so long as you try to avoid killing the civilians around. And of course, the government claims, I think honestly, that they're trying to avoid the civilians around. So the just war theory isn't really as sharp as a just peacemaking. Just peacemaking says what you've got to do is try to take initiatives. There are three I have in mind here. Well, there are 10 of them, but I want to mention, first of all, you've got to try to work to improve human rights for the people in the area. You see, what's happened is that, for example, during the Bush administration, they first of all had this declared permanent war on terrorists, which meant Muslim terrorists. Mm-hmm. Secondly, war on Afghanistan. Thirdly, war on Iraq. And listen to these astounding numbers, Wilton. The war on Iraq began in 2003. That year, there were just 208 international terrorist attacks. But when the war started, and the other two were already declared and happening, 3,000 terrorist attacks the next year, from 208 up to 3,168. The following year, 2005, there were 11,111 international terrorist attacks. And then in 2006, it was 14,500. Hmm. Each time, of course, the number of people killed by the terrorist attacks went up equally. And today's Los Angeles Times says that the United States is, according to polls, more unpopular in Pakistan, where we're doing a lot of these drone attacks, more unpopular there than in any other country. Because the Pakistanis really resent a violation of their human rights that the U.S. is using these drones to attack Pakistani people without permission, with direct opposition from the Pakistani government. So we've got to switch over from thinking the way to combat terrorism is by killing people in those very countries to rather a policy of trying to improve the human rights for the people in those countries,
right?
So that then we can get more support and also have the people feel that the United States is on the side of their human rights.
Yeah.
They don't think that now.
Tell us a little of how you came to this whole theory of just peacemaking as a better approach to this than the just war theory. That's historical and peacemaking and scriptural as well, isn't it?
Well, I was actually studying the Sermon on the Mount and other teachings of Jesus, and it's so clear that what Jesus teaches is not just what you should not do, like don't make this kind of war, but rather it's all about initiatives, about, you know, going the second mile, going to your brother and trying to talk it through and make peace, working on investing our treasures in justice and God's kingdom. They're all initiatives, praying for your enemy. Mm-hmm. They're all positive initiatives. And so I thought, well, gee whiz, there must be a Christian ethic that just doesn't tell us what not to do, but that gives us the initiatives that work to make peace. And so it came out of my understanding the gospel. It's about grace, mm-hmm. about initiatives. Furthermore, Jesus wept over Jerusalem because they didn't know the practices that make for peace. So I better get to work on trying to lay out what are these practices that are really working now to make for peace. I published two books, each called Just Peacemaking, and several other books have now come out. The newest one is Formation for Life, Just Peacemaking. And it's really spreading. President Obama endorsed all 10 practices of just peacemaking one by one in his Nobel Peace Award address. Mm-hmm. And now we got to press him to do it on this particular drone question.
Glenn, I can't help but think of this new technology as less of a 21st century triumph and more of a sign of utter failure. It's as if we've given up on the possibility of identifying threats on a human level and found a way to justify making the process as inhuman as possible. Is this a coward's way of waging war?
Well, you know, I don't want to totally attack President Obama. He rightly wanted to get out of the Afghanistan war and the Iraq war with our boots on the ground and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it was started by President George W. Bush, and he mm-hmm. recommended the drone attacks to President Obama. I want to give President Obama some credit for trying to get out of the direct war. And the drone attacks are supposed to be more precise, but they miss a lot. And so they hit these civilians, and they create enormous hostility against the United States, which then makes more recruits for terrorism.
Yeah.
So I just want us to feel empowered that if we can work on human rights, and the second justice-making practice is helping to develop the sustainable and just economic development in those countries so they see some hope, they see some positive way to go, then we can decrease the hatred of the United States, decrease the recruitment of terrorism, and this actually works. We can be empowered if we really embody our U.S. tradition of human rights and of helping economic development. That's the way to reduce terrorism. Human rights actually first arose from a Baptist, Richard Overton, during the Puritan struggle for religious liberty. It was in 1647 that the Baptist Richard Overton wrote the first comprehensive doctrine of human rights. So human rights are really our baby as Christians. And we just had a conference at Fuller Seminary with Muslim and Christian speakers talking about how if we emphasize human rights, we can be empowered to reduce the hatred that leads to recruitment to terrorism. Actually, now the number of international terrorist attacks are coming down slightly because the administration is shifting more over to, you know, the kind of human rights emphasis that President Obama talked about in his Cairo address.
Yeah.
So I'm encouraging our fellow Christians to nurture our baby, human rights. Here's the thing. In the U.S., there are almost no homegrown Muslim terrorists because Muslims in the United States are saying, we've got religious liberty, we've got pretty good human rights, we want to support this trend, and we want to discourage other Muslims around the world from terrorism. Instead, let's all together support human rights, and then we have a better way to go. So, you know, it's amazing if you think about it. Those Boston bombers, they were Russians. We just aren't producing homegrown Muslim terrorists because we're working on human rights. We got to do it more. But that's what I'm encouraging Christians to support.
I'm so glad. There are reports now that suggest that some of our military actions qualify as war crimes. But even if we accept that, it's discouraging to remember how universally humanity has abdicated any real call for accountability, at least in the past. So many of the killers in Nazi Germany escaped any consequences. Russia is led by a former KGB officer. Abu Ghraib was never really treated as a systemic moral failing, and the list goes on and on. If we are to accept the frightening possibility that real accountability can only happen going forward, the human nature tends to prevent its application after the fact, what difference would that make in how we authorize, as a society, killing in our collective name?
We would need the policy of the government to become public so we can discuss it. The trouble about the drone attacks is they're so secret, so we really can't do our checks and balances. We would make it more in the open so we can discuss it. On the other side, as you were saying, it's an undermining of our ethics. Rick Warren said that torture, like in Abu Ghraib, is corrupting the soul of our nation. And I think he's right. But on the other hand, I want to point out that in the first half of the 20th century, last century, there were an average of 3.5 million people killed each year in war, but it dropped to 0.8 million in the second half of the 20th century because of these just peacemaking practices. And so the more we teach just peacemaking, get one of the books called Just Peacemaking, teach them in churches, get Christians to support practices of just peacemaking, and we reduce the killings, we reduce the hostility, and we reduce the terrorism.
Dr. Glenn Stassen is the author of numerous books, including Just Peacemaking, Transforming Initiatives for Justice and Peace, and most recently, A Thicker Jesus, Incarnational Discipleship in a Secular Age. Dr. Stassen is Louis B. Smead's Professor of Christian Ethics at Fuller Theological Seminary in California. Glenn, when this subject came up, I said Glenn Stassen is the one that needs to talk about this with us, and I am very grateful to you for taking time to talk with us and share the really powerful insights that you have shared. Thanks for doing that today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much, Weldon. Great to talk with you.
You know, it wasn't long ago that interfaith marriage was relatively rare. And if religion played a role in family life, children likely would be raised in the tradition of one parent or the other. While that comes with its own built-in challenges, an alternative scenario is emerging which see kids growing up as both. Susan Katz-Miller was raised Jewish in an interfaith family and today is raising a family with her Christian husband. But her children are described well by the title of Susan's brand new book, Being Both, Embracing Two Religions in One Interfaith Family. And I'm very happy that the publication of this book brings Susan Katz-Miller to State of Belief Radio. Susan, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
A good way for us to begin. A quick background of your own interfaith upbringing and now how that informed the decisions that you've made with your family and with your children.
My mother decided that she would agree to have us be Jewish. And so she put aside her Christianity. She learned to make matzo balls. She studied Hebrew so that she could follow along with us in synagogue. And she shepherded all four of her children through the rigorous bar and bat mitzvah preparation. So she became a great, what's now called all but conversion, mother of a Jewish family. Sometimes she refers to herself as a common law Jew. But as an adult, when I had to decide with my husband how to raise our children, I really couldn't imagine doing what she did, which was to give up my own religion, in my case, Judaism. I'm a feminist, and my mother put aside her career and stayed home to raise four kids. She also capitulated on this question of religion. And for me, it's hard to imagine doing that. Part of what I write about in the book is that any pathway you choose, whether it's one or the other or both or neither, each of these pathways is going to have really distinct benefits, but also distinct challenges. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges I faced when my parents gave me this label of Jewish was that I've had to defend that identity throughout my lifetime. Mm. And this is partly, as you probably know, from an Orthodox or a conservative perspective, I'm not considered Jewish because it's patrilineal. Mm-hmm. So I've had to defend my Jewish identity. And this also led me to realize that kids born into interfaith families are going to have to defend their identities no matter what that identity is. Mm-hmm. They're always going to have that interfaithness. And so that's part of why my husband and I decided to do both. The choice of both had distinct benefits. And part of that is that I have been out in the world. I've lived in Muslim countries. I've lived in Catholic countries. And I wanted my children to be global citizens and to be literate in both of their ancestral religions, mm-hmm. to understand references to both testaments in literature. And I really see a lot of parallels with a couple who speak two different languages and want their child to be bilingual. Mm-hmm. Because growing up, I was really very ignorant of Christianity. And I think in American culture, it's very helpful to understand Christianity. In fact, there are Jewish scholars such as Amy Jill Levine, mm-hmm. who are very Jewish, but who are advocating for all Jewish children to have better education in Christianity. Mm-hmm. But certainly those who have an interfaith extended family, it's very important to me that my kids get both of those sets of texts and rituals and the knowledge and the histories. Mm-hmm. All of that is important to us.
How has it been living in a family practicing two different religions?
The biggest drawback that families talk about is the necessity of having to explain yourself all the time. Mm-hmm. People don't understand it. They're sometimes really challenged by it and bothered by it. But again, as an interfaith child, you're going to have to defend your identity no matter what it is. So what we find really helpful is that we have formed these communities in the major cities, in Washington, in New York, in Chicago. There are communities that have formed Sunday schools, religious education programs for these children, where they learn both religions side by side. And that also really helps kids with their sense of self-esteem and the sense that they're doing something that is not marginal or different.
Mm-hmm. If I ask your children separately, what's your religion? What would they say?
Well, they're still teenagers, and I always caution that, you know, none of us end up a single thing. Uh-huh. All of us are continuing to shift and change, and, you know, these Pew Research studies have shown the tremendous fluidity and flexibility of religion in America, and that's even for people who grow up with a single religion. Interfaith kids perhaps are going to be even more likely to shift throughout their lifetimes. My kids are still teens. Both of them still claim both religions. Mm-hmm. They're also both very interested in Buddhism. Mm. And what I did for this book was, rather than just writing about my own family, I surveyed parents and teens and young adults who grew up in these interfaith programs. And what I was seeing is that the young people who went through these interfaith education programs often feel strongly that they want to keep both. Mm-hmm. And that they don't feel that that's immature, that they feel like they get benefits from both. Some of them do choose a single religion.
Mm-hmm.
So there has been concern that if you raise them with both, they'll never choose.
Yeah.
And I don't see that either. I do see young people choosing.
You found something in researching for this book that I think will surprise our listeners. You say almost a third of married Americans have a spouse with a different religious background.
There are a lot of different statistics, by the way, and it depends on how you define interfaith. If you include Protestant, Catholic, or evangelical Protestant, mainline Protestant as interfaith, then that percentage gets much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of discussion about what the true number is. But it's definitely a very significant percentage of Americans at this point.
Yeah.
And the interfaith marriage rates of other religious minorities beyond Judaism has been growing for Muslims, for Hindus, for Buddhists, all of these.
Where I grew up and when I grew up, interfaith was Presbyterians and Baptists. But you're right. The world has changed in many ways. I would assume that celebrating both Judaism and Christianity would be good for holidays because the holidays have somewhat compatible themes and that kind of thing. What was the biggest challenge between distinguishing the two religions within the home?
One of the biggest challenges is burnout, because if you try to celebrate the full set of two holidays, it's almost like you're in a continuous holiday mode, and it gets exhausting. And you do have to pick and choose, but every family picks and chooses.
Mm-hmm.
And every religion has a process of curating, you know, which rituals are going to be considered obsolete and which are going to be the most compelling and which are the most important to preserve. That process goes on continuously. In my family, I think certainly my children enjoyed all of the holidays. Our family tries hard to go beyond the obvious of Hanukkah and Christmas, mm-hmm. Easter and Passover. I'm very aware that families who do both are sometimes accused of doing nothing. And we are trying to be sort of maximalists rather than minimalists. And so we do not just Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah in the fall, but Sukkot and Simchat Torah. But we also celebrated the blessing of the animals in mm-hmm. honor of St. Francis.
Mm-hmm.
My kids have a great-great-grandfather who was a circuit-riding rabbi in the 19th century in Mississippi and Louisiana, mm-hmm. serving small Jewish communities on the river. I want my children to grow up knowing that story and understanding what it means to be a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a great-great-grandfather who was an Episcopal bishop of Newark.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine raising them in a way such that they don't understand what it means to be an Episcopalian and to mm-hmm. be a bishop and the significance of that ancestor.
When you and your husband got married, you brought in not just yourselves, but your parents and the extended families of different traditions. How did the extended family accept your decision?
We were very lucky. We had a very long courtship, and by the time we got married, I think our families were just happy we were getting married. And that pattern repeated the pattern for my own parents who intermarried. And they also, because of their long courtship, because they got married relatively late in life, their families were really just happy that they were getting married. But I know it's not that easy for every family. I mean, there are still families where this is a real challenge.
Where do interfaith families find support and someone to help them understand how to relate to the community, all the questions that come up that are not givens in people's lives? They need someone to help them.
Traditionally, there have been a number of places that interfaith families have turned to for that kind of community, religious community. A lot of them have been welcomed in the Unitarian Universalist congregations. Mm-hmm. Some of them choose secular humanism or ethical society. But more and more, there are progressive Jewish communities and progressive Christian Protestant communities and Catholic that are welcoming these families.
Right.
So I think that that support is really crucial. And it's important for children to have community and for spouses to have community. And if you can't find one of those communities that's welcoming in your geographic area, I would encourage you, if you're open to the idea of doing both, to start an interfaith families support group.
Mm-hmm.
The group that my family belongs to in Washington has over 100 children in the interfaith Sunday school. And the groups in Chicago and New York are similar in being very large, thriving organizations. But all you really need is, say, four other interfaith families who want to get together for Shabbat once a month or to celebrate holidays. And you can have that kind of support and compare notes. And then if you want to, go on and form a sort of one-room schoolhouse and start an interfaith education program.
Yeah. Susan, is there something in this book that you really wanted to talk about that I haven't asked you and given you a chance to talk about?
One point I wanted to bring up, and this is perhaps more subtle, is that there's a lot of interfaith activism and interfaith dialogue going on, especially since 9/11. And this is great. It's very important for our world. And these are events and conversations that you often take one Christian, one Jew, one Hindu, one Muslim, and have them engage in conversation or do community service together. That's all great. But there's been a sort of an invisible wall between that conversation and the interfaith families conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes interfaith families are seen as threatening because they are bridging these barriers that we're trying to put up. And the ambiguity is hard sometimes for religious institutions to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making the argument in this book that people from interfaith families, whether they're intermarried or they're interfaith children, actually have tremendous skills in building those bridges. They live day and night 24/7 in these interfaith conversations, and they have a lot to contribute to interfaith peacemaking. And
mm-hmm.
I would like to see some of these young interfaith adults coming up be part of that interfaith conversation.
That's a great point.
Talking to these children in particular is very exciting because they are so articulate about their place as ambassadors, people who can sit with a friend who's Jewish, a friend who's Christian, a friend who's Muslim, and help that group to function. They have those skills of cross-cultural, cross-faith communication.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping that's what I would find, and I did find it. And
Good.
The book is filled with the stories of these children, of these couples, and
Good.
All of those examples are, of course, very encouraging to me.
Susan Katzmiller is the author of Being Both, Embracing Two Religions in One Interfaith Family. The book's just been published by Beacon Press. Susan is a former Newsweek reporter. She writes frequently at the Huffington Post and elsewhere. Thank you for coming in and being a part of State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Before we go today, I want to share with you sadness that has captivated the Interfaith Alliance National Family. This past week, the sudden death of Pam Baldwin, both shocked us and saddened us. Pam has served for years as the executive director of Interfaith Alliance of Idaho. Pam was an honest, sincere, dedicated woman, both in her work and in her personal life. She could never get away from her concerns about people being treated unjustly. She wanted to see her community become much more of a holistic entity. The work of the Interfaith Alliance was the work to which she wanted to give her life, protecting people's freedom, advocating for religious freedom, and seeing to it that we live in a pluralistic society. At the heart of her work professionally was the deep personal concern she had for what's going on in our nation and in her community. So we talked a lot about justice issues. We talked about interfaith cooperation and diversity, and she was a real rabid advocate of the kind of work that Interfaith Alliance does. I guess she was best known in her community for standing by the Muslim members of her community after 9/11. She did a lot of development of workshops to combat hate crimes. She was a mentor to many of our other Interfaith Alliance leaders, and our thoughts and prayers are with Pam's husband, Bob, her children, and the rest of her family and friends. A reporter asked me this week about Pam and what some of my thoughts were regarding her work, and one of the questions was an interesting one. Who's going to take Pam's place? And I said, you know, no one's going to take her place. Someone can pick up the values that she has demonstrated so well and step in and start that work. But we are always at work trying to find new voices, new activists, not to replace anybody, but to strengthen our work. You may not have known Pam, but I guarantee you she shared values that the listeners to this radio show share. And that means that this may be an opportunity to get you inspired, to pick up your tools of labor and go to work for us on defending religious freedom and advocating justice and bringing about the affirmation of all people for religious pluralism. We'll miss Pam. We will be sad at her passing, but we also will be hopeful that there are people like who listen to this show, who may step up to the plate now and begin their work. I hope so. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a contribution today. We'll use it wisely, I promise you that. We'll use it to keep State of Belief on the air, to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem even to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, sign up for our podcast. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. Our listener line is 800-856-0277. We encourage you to tell others about the show and join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.